I've been thinking about what I wanted to say tonight for several days, and every day I think about doing something, and then something happens, and then the next day I think I'm going to say something else. And I think that mostly this is the result of our experience in Long Beach. So I want to talk about that a little bit. And we talked about that broken pot on the bowl on the table, and I said, I hope, you know, it wasn't exactly an omen. And did you say something about predicting something, or somebody said something about predicting something? Anyway, I tend to think of omens or unusual circumstances, symbolic events, as psychic weather, as I said. So the symbolic event of our being in Long Beach was we stayed on the Queen Mary, which is a boat. And when I lived in L.A., I didn't think anything of it when they first sort of hauled it into Long Beach. But I thought it would be kind of fun to, stay there when we went down. And Carolyn stayed on the Queen Mary also. But we really got into it. We learned about it. And in its time, it was the fastest liner in the North Atlantic. It was so fast that it was used as a troop ship during the Second World War. And the fastest destroyers and such that needed to protect it couldn't keep up with it. It was just that fast. It was unbelievably fast. It was, I guess, the North Atlantic crossing used to take 6 days, seven sometimes, and the Queen Mary would do it in four. It was really fast. And it was all decked out unbelievably, and some of that stuff remained. It was Art Deco, and it was really a kick to stay there. But the symbolic side was, in a certain sense, even more interesting. And I'll come back to what that is in a bit. As you all know, and because some of you went through this experience a year ago, this event, this initiation and teachings were supposed to happen a year ago. And, Kay and I spent 6 months preparing for that, and we were really looking forward to it because we saw it as being very rare, and to take these teachings, Vajrabhairava Yamantaka teachings from His Holiness, does happen, but not in the United States. I don't believe he's ever done that outside of India. We actually did take this particular, or a version of this particular initiation from him at the end of the long retreat that we did at Namgyal Monastery in the early 90s. But a year ago, I was sick, Kay was sick, but we showed up. His Holiness was sick and he didn't show up. other people had other difficulties in getting there and obstacles. And it was sort of the nature of the event. And that was just, that was interesting. And sometimes the circumstances that create these unusual gatherings, they're difficulties. They're just difficulties in these things coming together. I mean, we've often seen, Kay and I have often seen that in our lives where meeting with the lamas in certain special ways, there are obstacles that you have to go through to get there. There are things that get in the way. And a lot of times you just, in my experience anyway, a lot of times you just have to say, these are like the guardians, like in the Gothic cathedrals in Europe. They have these gargoyle things, and the Japanese temples have fierce warrior types standing at the doors. And I don't know what this is about, but it does seem that there are times where you just have to say, here is this force or these circumstances that are making things impossible, and you just have to somehow say, this is so desirable that I'm going to push through it no matter what. And of course, sometimes it whacks you over the head, and sometimes it gets out of the way, and all kinds of different things happen. It depends upon all kinds of different things. And a year ago, all of us had all kinds of different things happening. I was so dizzy that I could barely walk. People were holding by a hand, and Kay's head was exploding and ringing in her ears and all kinds of things. It was just... So we pushed through it to be there, but the there wasn't there because he didn't show up. And says, okay, now, you know, then what's going to happen? So, you know, I don't know, a few weeks or a month after the event, the center in Long Beach said, well, we invited him to come back again, and he said he would, so it's going to be a year from now. So then it was like, okay, now we have another year to prepare for this, and, you know, what's going to happen in the next year, and are we going to be ready for this? And my life went through huge changes during that year, and in a very significant way for me, it was much better to happen this year than last year. And so that's an interesting dimension to all of this also, which is that, you know, I mean, the world doesn't center around me, so the event didn't happen last year because it was not a good thing for me. It didn't happen because it didn't happen, but in a sense, it, you know, it was kind of better that it happened this year. And I was more prepared for it. My life had gone through some changes that made the situation more opportune. Now I share all this not because, you know, my story is all that interesting, but because a large part of growing in Buddhist practice is spending time with teachers. And when I say spending time with teachers, I'm talking about teachers who have deep realization. There's nobody that I'm aware of who has a deeper experience of the truth, however we want to think of it, than the Dalai Lama. There's a way in which you can't judge these things. I mean, our own personal teacher has very profound experience. He's actually the lineage holder for Yamantaka. But Dalai Lama is just sort of like in a different solar system or something. You know, I don't even know how to express this. And teachers like that are what Bob Thurman once referred to as living icons, which is really interesting language, living icons. Now, you know, in most traditions, most religious traditions, iconic art is a very special kind of art. It's not necessarily realistic, and it serves a specific function. So tankas, for example, are iconic art. They're not meant to be totally realistic. They're meant to be... sort of an interface or a window or a doorway into another dimension, if you will. And, you know, if they look just like this world, they wouldn't serve that function anymore. So icons have their own characteristics, specific shapes. The Tibetan icons are drawn on grid patterns, specific colors. All the iconography is very special. So a living icon, what's a living icon? A living icon is somebody who has made a deep connection with their real self, with their deepest self. And that's why they're a living icon, because what the icon is about is a tool to reflect your deepest self back to you. So maybe an icon is more like a mirror than a window. You know, you look at the icon and you're looking at what you really are. When you look at a mirror, you just see your body, and maybe you see your mind if your body is twitching or something. But when you look at an iconic mirror, you see what you really are. So when you're looking at a real teacher, you're seeing what you really are. And that's really important, because that is what you really are, except you don't see it. You don't see yourself in that way. Because we live on the surface. And there's It's not like there's something wrong with living on the surface. I mean, that's not a judgmental statement. I mean, this is how we make our lives work. We go to work. We drive cars. I mean, all this kind of stuff. That's living on the surface. That's okay. But it's easy to get so distracted that we lose track of and can no longer find our deepest self. And that's the situation pretty much everybody is in. We've lost track of that. So when you find a real teacher, you find somebody who has not lost track of their real self. Or if they lost track of it, they found it again, and that's where they're living. So when you look at that person, you're looking at what you really are, except you don't remember it. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so wonderful to be around people like that. Because it's sort of like, as Kay would say, coming home to yourself, though. It's like coming home to yourself. And I think that that's why we're attracted to people like that. Because when we're around them, it's easy, you know, to be very psychological and say, well, you're projecting father images onto him and all, you know, all this transference stuff and whatnot. But I think that that's really superficial. I mean, that's probably true for many people. But I really think that what it's about is that you're coming home in the sense of you're remembering yourself. You're seeing yourself when you see somebody like that. And that's why it's important to see somebody like that. Because otherwise you don't know what to look for when you're looking for yourself. It's like when we say something like, we'll meditate on the mind, we think we know what our mind is. But actually, if we go through a whole process of trying to find our minds, we're going to discover relatively quickly that we don't know what our minds are or how to find it or what it looks like or what it does or anything like that. What we find is we have a lot of ideas about what our mind is or what our consciousness is, and we can find those things very easily. But to find what they refer to, and many of them are just kind of like distortions and wrong, but to find what they're referring to, even if incorrectly, is not easy. So the real teacher is, real teacher shows that to us. And I'm talking about the Dalai Lama, but you know, there are a lot of teachers who are like that. I mean, Zatshoje is somebody that we've all met and that we know. And I know from hanging around him that he's in touch with his deepest self in a way that I find very elusive. So being with him is a reminder of that. And that's why we like to be with people like that. And there are many lamas who are around who can serve that purpose. I mean, well, that sounds very instrumental. I don't mean to, you know, phrase it in a way that sounds interesting. But that actually, well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Because that's their job, right? That is their purpose. Their purpose is to take their own practice and their own personal realization and show it to you. That's their purpose. That's their job. That's what they're about. So anyway, in Long Beach, that's what His Holiness was doing. He was sort of like just there. And sometimes he was just there like, you know, like your favorite uncle telling stories, as Kay said. You know, at one point he was sort of like doing fireside chats or whatnot. And other times he was there as the, you know, the guy who's telling the truth. And saying things that you don't too much hear anyplace else. And when he says those things, you know, there's a something special atmosphere, energy, if you will, that is kind of like goes with it. But it's also a challenge. And it's not like all sweetness and light because, you know, they're the obstacles of getting there, they're the obstacles of being there, and then there are all the stuff that happens afterwards. And I remember when I was a graduate student, one of the professors in my doctoral program was someone called Thubten Norbu, who's now deceased, but he's the Dalai Lama's elder brother. And he had, through some complicated circumstances, ended up as a professor at Indiana University. And while we were there, I mean, while I was there as a student, I had a friend who got in the car one day with some buddies and drove to, so this is Indiana, he drove to Boulder, Colorado, because the Karmapa was there. The Karmapa is the main teacher in one of the four main sects in Tibetan Buddhism. which was like, yeah, wow, great. You know, this guy was in the United States for the first time. What a great opportunity to see him. For whatever reason, I didn't go. I don't know why that was. I was a graduate student. I couldn't get away or what. I can't even remember anymore. So I never had the opportunity to meet the Karmapa. Anyhow, so my friends had all kinds of misadventures coming back. Anything horrible could happen, it happened. You know, car problems, health problems, spooks came out of the woodwork. I mean, you just cannot believe this stuff. And they, you know, but we were all young and stupid, so we survived everything back then. And they survived it all. They came back to Bloomington and they shared the information, or they shared the stories with us. Tupten Norbu said, well, when you go to see people like this, you know, they're not ordinary people. Stuff happens. And don't go see people like this unless you're willing to have the stuff happen. So what did you think? And they said, oh, you know, they weren't thinking. He said, well, you should have been thinking, because this, you know, not like you shouldn't have gone. Sure you should, but stuff happens. So we've come back and stuff is happening. Boy, is stuff happening, you know. That's good. That's okay, you know. So the other thing about that was going on there was, in his teachings, he said a lot of things that, well, this may sound weird, but he didn't really say much of anything I hadn't heard before, quite honestly. But it was great to hear it again, because I'd forgotten a lot of it. And sometimes he'd said it to me, and he reminded me that, oh, okay, right. And, you know, so I've been doing okay for the last 10 years, because I forgot you told me to do something, and I did it. And I've been doing it, and now you're telling everybody that's what they're supposed to do, so I guess I did good, you know. So that's nice. Then there are the other things that I didn't do good. Oh, I'm supposed to do that? I forgot that. All right. So it was, you know, no swelled head here. It was a mixed bag, of course. But one of the things that he did talk about was, he talked about what his translator called the fundamental mind of clear light. The fundamental mind of clear light is the essence of who we are. That's our Buddha nature, for that language. It's what we are that's gotten covered over by all of our experience and our habits, good, bad, or indifferent, and our daily involvement in the world and our distractions and everything else. And the point of practice is to recover our relationship with that fundamental mind. It's not language that I've used in this group. I've usually talked about Buddha mind or Buddha nature or consciousness or something like that. But it's all the same thing. And so probably fundamental mind of clear light will be something you'll hear from me more, because that was the language he used, and that's the specific translation that Tubten Jimpa used for this. And since he's about the best translator going, I'll adopt that language. He talked about that a lot. And so that's what the teacher is. The teacher is somebody that spends a lot of time dipping into the fundamental mind of clear light and then coming back out into ordinary reality and going back in and coming back out and going back in and coming back out on a daily basis, in, out, but maybe more than once a day. I mean, I don't know how frequently people can do this sort of thing, or at least get close to it, if not get into it. I don't know. I can't judge their practice. But what the living icon is, what the real teacher is somebody who can show that to you. Somebody who can show that to you, which is within you, but you can't see it. And the reason you can't see it is it's what's doing the seeing. It's the awareness that's aware of everything. And that's why it's hard to be aware of it. But you can be aware of somebody else's awareness who is there. So that's a good reason for hanging out with teachers also. Now, one of the things that he did not talk about, but that he has many other times talked about, is he's talked about the individual mind stream. So what's the relationship of the individual mind stream and the fundamental mind of clear light? Well, in a lot of religious traditions, the teaching seems to be, in essence, we're all the same thing. You know, it's like God's within you, God's within me, God's within or pussycat, maybe, probably. Yes, gods within our pussycat. And there's only one God, so there's only one reality within all of us. And so the deepest reality is when I'm looking into your eyes, I'm seeing myself looking back at me. I just don't know it. So we've heard about these kinds of things. But His Holiness often in His teachings has said, your mind stream is your mind stream. The fundamental clear light in you is the fundamental clear light in you, which is different than it is in me. And it's like, how is this reconcilable? This doesn't make any sense. Now, he didn't talk about it this last time, you know. But I felt like the point that he's making is the following. That we're each uniquely ourselves. We each uniquely have our own mind stream or clear light mind or whatever you want to call it. But as the Tibetans say, they're all of one taste. It's like, you know, the water that's in Jane's cup and the water that's in Kayla's cup came from the same tap. It's the same water, but it's in two different cups. Same water, but it truly is in two different cups. So it seems paradoxical. It's both the same and different. And I think for some reason he stressed, in many cases, the difference. Although, in Long Beach, he didn't say anything about it one way or the other, that it's all the same or that it's all different. He didn't really go there that I can recall. And I think that he does this because it's easy for us to say that within our meditation practice, within our striving after returning to who we really are, it's easy to give up a sense of responsibility for being an individual and the individual responsibility we have to other individuals. And I think that that's the reason that he makes this point, is to help people guard against that. I mean, you wouldn't think that that's a problem because, I mean, we're not really spending a whole lot of time floating around in the clear light mind. But I think it's easy on a sort of a rational level to say, well, you know, it really doesn't matter what I do or what I say to such and such another person because it's really, there's not much difference between us. And so it's like, you know, it's like I'm biting my own finger. So if I want to bite my finger, I can bite my finger. Who cares? It's my finger. So I'll bite it. Well, no, in this particular case, it's somebody else's finger you're biting, you know. I mean, you both have fingers, so in that sense, you're the same, but somebody else's finger. I don't know where that metaphor came from. Anyway. So, I said I'd talk about the Queen Mary, and that's sort of where we'll end up. In the Buddhist tradition, there are sort of what are called different turnings of the wheel, which is to say sort of different dispensations or schools of thought. We talked about this a little bit. So one vehicle or one school of thought is called the individual vehicle, or sometimes it's called the vehicle of the elders or the Theravada or the Hinayana. Yana is the word for vehicle. Sometimes the old translations were raft, but the current translations are more like vehicle. But the idea of it being like a boat, see, now I get to Queen Mary, the idea of it being like a boat or a vehicle is real, you know, and there's a reason why that language was used rather than ox cart or something like that, you know. So the Tibetan tradition, although it incorporates the Theravada Hinayana, it's founded on the Mahayana view of things, which is the view that we're all in it together in some way, and we all have to help each other move forward. That's why it's called the Great Vehicle, because it's the vehicle that includes everybody. It's the boat that everybody can get on to go forward. In the Hinayana Theravada tradition, it's sort of like you got your own boat and you got to do your own rowing and nobody's going to help. Right? But in the Mahayana tradition, it's more like you're on the Queen Mary, which is like the fast route, you know. Queen Mary had, I think I saw an old ad that was on the wall there, 200,000 horsepower or something like that. I mean, it was something phenomenal. Of course, it was a gas guzzler beyond belief. But nevertheless, it was the real Mahayana. It was, right? So, but what is the Mahayana? I mean, it's sort of like, it's all the people together. It's all those individualized, clear-like minds in relationship to each other, sort of holographically filling the space that we're living in right now, all together with a shared intention to support each other in finding the truth of who we are and being kind to each other and being kind to the world and moving forward as a collectivity. But not a collectivity in which individuality is obliterated. And see, that's the point of the Dalai Lama's teaching. It's a collectivity in which individuality is actually treasured. I mean, the lamas that we've met are all unique personalities. I mean, our current teacher, Denma Lhotse Rinpoche, was friends with our former teacher, Tara Tulku, but they were so different from each other, just totally, totally different personalities. And there was no sense of, there's something wrong with my personality, I got to do something about my personality. It's more like, this is who I am, I mean, Tara Tulku he scared the crap out of his debate partners because he was known as the fiercest debater around. Gave me a hard time a lot of times, about these kinds of things. And Lhotse Rinpoche was just as smart, no question about it. He was actually an upperclassman at Tara Tulku, but he didn't have that particular reputation. He was a little bit of a rebel, actually. In fact, he still is. So Tara Tulku was much more like a company guy, And so they all have their personalities. There was no sense of it needs to go away. It was much more like enriching. It was more like art. It's like living in this world is like art. And, so they treasured what they were, and they treasured every individual as an individual without a sense of like, you can't be that person. You have to be a different person. No, it's like you are who you are, and we love you for who you are. That's a good thing. So now I'm going to kick your ass because you have to wake up a little bit, but you're still an okay person, it's not like there's something wrong with you. Change. It's more like, no, you're fine, but wake up, please. Whack, whack. But you're fine. So, but that's, that's an important distinction. It's like Zachoje saying, maybe you did not do a good thing, but you're still a good person. It's the distinction between the person and the action. And His Holiness talks about this. He's been asked questions about some seriously bad guys like Osama bin Laden, And he said, well, as a human being, he's a human being. He deserves affection as a human being. But he did some really bad stuff, and it's good he's not around anymore. That's an interesting distinction, Not like I'm happy he was killed or anything like that, but just like he drew the distinction between what was being done and the essence of who the person was. And he would not go to the place of, the mound. He told this story when we were down there that just blew people away. Something blew me away. When he was a teenager, he had to negotiate with Mao Zedong over the future of Tibet. Boy, kayabanga. So, and Mao, some people actually tallied up, who were the worst people of the 20th century in terms of mass slaughter? You think Hitler? He was only number three. Stalin was number two. Mao was number one. 50 million Chinese. 50 million Chinese died as a result of decisions he made, right? Dalai Lama said he cried when Mao died. And you know what the Chinese communist invasion did to Tibet? His Holiness said he cried when Mao died. Why? He said, because I knew what was waiting for him. He was not going to go to a good place and have good things happen, not doing that kind of stuff. So he cried for this poor being who was going to have to suffer in this way. I mean, that's unbelievable. Just unbelievable. So anyhow, back to the Mahayana. I'm getting distracted here and I'm running over time. So back to the Mahayana. So all of us as individuals, and yet all sharing the one taste of the clear light mind. And that is what the great vehicle is. And we're all in it together. And fortunately, we have, you know, good folks down in the engine room and good folks on the bridge and good folks in the radio room, you know, not like on the Titanic. And, you know, they're paying attention and they're being helpful. And this, you know, this great Mahayana is, you know, it's like moving all of us forward, whether we know it or not. I mean, I find myself sitting here in the Grand, and every once in a while, I just sort of like think about, you know, His Holiness, and I just sort of like tune into that, and I can just feel that quality of His presence. You know, I mean, He's right here. He's on the planet here with us. You know, I mean, maybe He's in this room. I don't know, but that's not what I mean, huh?
The light did blink.
You saw a lot of that on.
It was nothing. There are no accidents.
So anyhow, so that's actually the wonderfulness of Mahayana, is that you know, all of us together are the vehicle. I mean, and this all of us is not just the us in this room. It's sort of like, it's vast, and it's not just vast in the now. It's vast in the past and vast in the present, and it's all interconnected. And I've talked about those sort of things. I'll talk about them again, but that's the real wonderfulness of it. Mm-hmm. So that's all I want to say about it.
Questions?
It's 24 after 7. Questions. Okay, questions. Sure. Okay, questions. No questions. There are no questions.
Discussion.
There's only answers.
Would the fundamental, what was the term you used?
Fundamental mind of clear light.
Would that be the same as the sky mind you discussed? Did you
yes. That? Yes. Sky-like mind. Yeah. The different language that are used for this same thing. Now, I may just have it wrong, and it's reasonably safe to assume I do. But if I don't, then my thought is that depending upon how you find it, it appears one way or the other. So, you know, we're born with this fundamental mind of clear light, and it's always there within us this very moment, because it's what we live out of. It's what does the knowing. But when we rediscover it in meditation practice, I think we rediscover it with this sense of expansiveness. And that's the sky-like mind. On the other hand, we can discover it in deep, dreamless sleep. It's the same thing. It's just we're not aware at that particular time. And we experience this mind every day. It's there right now. I mean, it's within us right now. It's just we're into our wakeful rationalness, so we don't notice it. And when we fall asleep and we're not dreaming, we're not attentive enough to notice it. You also experience it at the moment of death. It's called the clear light of death. And there are various other times when you experience it.
Somebody said, like, sneezing.
That's an interesting one,
yeah,
sneezing.
And yawning.
Yawning. So I must experience it a lot because I get sneezing
yeah.
spells.
Yeah. And sexual orgasm. And a couple or something.
I don't faint. Fainting.
Oh, fainting. Yeah.
Those are the only ones I'm aware of.
Fainting?
Fainting.
Fainting. Oh,
fainting. It'd be nice if you could experience it painting, but yeah, but unfortunately it's fainting. So I think, you know, I think that the reference is essentially the same thing, but I think that the different language speaks more to how you come upon it, under what circumstances you come upon it. Sometimes it's a matter of different schools talking about it, because there are different kinds of language in different Buddhist lineages, and it gets really confusing. That's one of the reasons they say, you know, it's not like
one lineage is better than another. It's not like the Galupas have it and the Kargyus don't have it or something like that. But they have different kinds of techniques and languages for practice. If you kind of go back and forth, it can get really confusing. His Holiness oftentimes in his teaching will say, he'll be talking about something, he said, now the Kagyus call it this, and this is their system, and the Nyingmas call it this, and this is their system, just to be sure you include everybody, because he's very non-sectarian in the Buddhist sense of non-sectarian. And then you're kind of like, how does he know this stuff? It's so complicated, you know, but he does. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Did you get a hold of the Garden Shasta Monastery in Long Beach about possibly getting a tape or video? Or
I wrote to them, but I haven't heard anything. You know, actually, I should check my spam filter. I should check my spam, not my spam filter, but my spam mailbox to see if it popped in there. Sometimes, you know how it is with emails. I should. I'll do that. I've been lax because I wrote to them a week or so ago. They may be trying to figure out what they're doing about all these things still. I mean, the abbot of Ganden Monastery was supposed to be staying on for a month of commentary on Yamantaka. So they may be very preoccupied with all that.
So what will happen when the Dalai Lama dies? Will we be without a Dalai Lama for a period of time until there's an incarnation, or how does that work?
Yeah. That's how it works. I mean, there's a period of time between one life and another, and then they've got to find him. That helps. It was. They found the current Dalai Lama when he was 4, which means there was probably about 5 years between one and the other, because, you know, I mean, there was a period of time after the death and before conception, and then there's a period of time in the mother's womb, and then there were the 4 years. So, you know, there's about 5 years back in that case. The next one is going to be very complicated, of course, because there's so many political machinations. Although he said he's abolished the political role of Dalai Lama. I mean, there's no governmental political responsibility anymore. It's gone. I mean, he prepared various assemblies and self-government among the refugee community, and he finally reached the point where he said, you don't need a Dalai Lama as a political leader anymore. But Dalai Lama as a spiritual teacher, yes, that's, I'll still do that thing. You know, that's right. Still my responsibility. But head of state, that's over with. And I'm not sure about this, but I think that one of the ways that this is manifest is there's a long-standing tradition in the first month of the year for public teachings that the Dalai Lamas would do. Thousands and thousands of people would show up within 2 weeks of the first part of the year. It was called the Monlam teachings. It was established. It was a tradition of teaching that was established by Tsongkhapa, which is the founder of the Galupa lineage, in the early 14th century. And so the Monlam teachings have been going on consistently, but they became identified with the political role of the Dalai Lama. And I've noticed over the last few years, there have been no Monlam teachings in Dharamsala. They happened every year. We attended them once. They happened every year. They've been going on every year for centuries, and they're just not going on anymore. And I thought, what is this? And the reason I know they're not going on is because, you know, internet. DalaiLama.com, what's his teaching schedule? No Monlam teachings. Previous year, no Monlam teachings. Previous year, no Monlam. I'm thinking, what's going on? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, it's because they were associated with his role as the governmental official, head of government. So he's making the point that this event is not happening anymore, because there is no political Dalai Lama anymore. And of course, I'm real practical about these things. You know, the Chinese will say that the Dalai Lama has been born in Tibet, and they'll have their own candidate. And even if they do, you know, what are they going to say? You know, we're going to put him up as the puppet head of state, but the Dalai Lama has made clear that the Dalai Lama has no political role anymore, and so that therefore, it's the Chinese who are giving a political role. So, I mean, that's the practical side of all of this. this, but yeah. Yeah, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. We had his presence about our life. It's just amazing to think of being without that.
Well, I practice guru yoga really deeply, and it's sort of my preparation, which is not to say that I won't be devastated to by his passing. Of course, the Tibetans say, next breath, next life, who knows which will come first in regards to any of us. So, you know, I may check out before he does. Statistically speaking, if you look at the odds, it's more likely to be the other way around. And you're right, it'd be devastating. But I didn't practice guru yoga with Tara Tulku. I didn't practice reaching out and feeling his presence wherever I was and wherever he was. And when he died, I didn't even know what I had missed until about a year later we actually met with His Holiness, because Tara Tulku said, go talk to him about your own practice. And he said a few things, and His Holiness said a few things to us, made me realize I'd screwed up big time by not practicing guru yoga. And I didn't exactly even know how that practice was a practice of being in relationship with your lama when he's not around. And so I started, when Moche Rinpoche started spending time with us, I started connecting with him. I thought, I am going to really cultivate this relationship on that kind of level. And it was really my intention to do that with His Holiness whenever I had the opportunity to go to teachings. I mean, and you can do that, you know. I mean, you can be in an amphitheater with 10,000 people and you can feel him, you can tune into him, and you can walk away with that connection and you can cultivate that. It's hard to maintain it over time, so you have to go back and, you know, sort of like get another taste, you know, and say, okay, now I remember this, and work with it. So, I mean, maybe it sounds a little bit selfish or something to say, you know, I'm, in a sense, preparing for this, but it isn't. I mean, it's the point of guru yoga is, you know, remembering that you've got a direct telephone connection with the bridge of the Queen Mary. Like, hey, you know, I just want to check in here, you know. So, give me a little juice, please.
Yeah, the Dalai Lama actually told us at that time that when we were questions went in, because we were devastated about Tara Tulku passing over, that he did say that we, it was primary for us to learn that there was really no difference between Tara Tulku being here on the planet right now and not being in his passing. Yeah. And that, you know, and so we had to kind of figure out, that was our koan, basically, we had to figure out what that meant. And I think it meant guru yoga, which we had been told to do, but, you know, the Yamataka practice itself was so involved, and actually it does have guru yoga within it, mm-hmm. too, in another slightly different form. So, you know, but so in a way we were doing it, but in a way we weren't practicing it six times a day and so on and so forth, because we didn't really understand that.
And I certainly didn't understand the deepest level of it, which is like that direct relationship. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that with whoever your teacher is. I mean, whether it's Zachoje or Mother Ma or Jesus Christ, I mean, it really, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, in terms of like the essence of what that practice is. Yeah. And again, the nice thing about the Mahayana, back to that, is if you're practicing in relationship with Zachoje, Zachoje is practicing in relationship with His Holiness. So, you know, these things all connect with each other, and His Holiness is practicing in relationship with Ling Rinpoche, and they're all connected up with Tsongkhapa, who's connected up with Atisha, who's connected up with Nagarjuna, who's connected up with Shakyamuni Buddha, and so it's like it's all bzzz. It's all connected. That is what the Mahayana is. It's all interconnected. You just have to find the place where you tap into it in a vital way, and then it's all there for you.
I might tell them about the tuning into the voice and the way to be in a situation where, you know, with like Zokuji or the Dalai or something, in case they are Demo Trubuche this summer. You might say something about that, like you did to Sandra and me.
All right. Well, I've talked to a lot of people who say, I go to these teachings and it's so boring. And there's all this Tibetan and I don't know the Tibetan, you know. And then finally there's a translation and then there's all this Tibetan again. And it's like I'm rolling my eyes waiting for the next translation. And I've people have said that. And I understand that. But when Tibetan teachers are speaking, they're speaking out of that place of the fundamental mind. You know, they're speaking out of it's like Manjushri speaking. So even if you don't know what they're saying has an energy to it which you can tap into. And so the advice I've given people in regards to the Dalai Lama is that you may not know Tibetan, but those who know Tibetan will tell you that he has the most refined, precise language of anybody they've ever heard. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, you think of the best British actor with the ultimate perfect accent, right? You know, that's him in Tibetan. So in these situations, you can listen to the energy. You can listen to what he says, and it's lyrical. I mean, it's true. It's a little weird because it's Tibetan until you get used to it. But when you get used to it, what you'll notice is his use of language is like ocean waves. His speech will build to a certain kind of crescendo, and then he'll make his point, and it's like the waves break, you know. And it just goes on and on like that. So I was telling our friend Sandra, who was saying, oh, yeah, it's like, you know, it's always Tibetan, and then finally there's some hard thing to understand. I said, Sandra, you know, don't worry about the hard thing to understand. Listen to the energy, tune into the energy of his speech. She said, okay, I'll try that. So I happened to notice her sitting there, and she fell into this meditative place for 3 hours and didn't move. So it's like, you know, so I checked in with her afterwards. She said, thank you. That was pretty far out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, with these teachers, there really is, it's mantra. It's like speech energy. It's quite amazing. And His Holiness has actually the most amazing speech. I mean, you listen to him in English, and it's this broken English, and it's kind of like, all right, what is this? This is like, you know, some great teacher, you know. But you listen to the Tibetan, and it's like after a while you actually start thinking you know what he's saying, even though you don't know the Tibetan. And I don't know colloquial Tibetan, you know. So, yeah. So if you have the opportunity, you know, and you're sitting in an amphitheater, and they have these mega speakers, and you're like, okay, here's, you know, I'm going to wait for the translation, and then it's going to be this hard thing to understand. Forget about that. Just like tune in. You know, you can listen to the audio recording another time. Just tune in. Let your mind flow with it. Enjoy the presence of it.